Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph. I'm Artemis Irvin, and in today's episode, we're travelling back to witness the twists and turns of a 300-year-old mystery. A prime minister on the brink of death, political parties rife with factionalism, and a cultural war which divided the nation. I could be describing the last year in politics, but in fact, I'm talking about the one we're discussing in today's episode, the year 1711. At the beginning of the 18th century, the country was still reeling from the events of the previous 60 years. The civil wars, the execution of the king, the invitation to a foreign monarch to come and take the throne, these are just a few of the political upheavals that had left deep and lasting scars on the British psyche. As such, while we tend to associate this period with the dawn of Enlightenment thinking, of religious toleration and freedom of the press, this period is equally defined by intolerance, censorship, and persecution. In today's episode, we visit a political scandal and mystery that in many ways seem to encapsulate some of these tensions and contradictions in British politics. Our expert guest on this journey is the writer, historian, and literary scholar Dr. Joseph Hone. Joseph is the author of three books, the first of which was shortlisted for the University English Books Prize in 2017. He currently teaches at Newcastle University, and his most recent book, The Paper Chase, is available to buy now. I spoke to Joseph just last week. Thank you so much for joining us on Travels Through Time today, Joseph.
Thank you for having me, Artemis.
So I thought we could just start by talking a bit about your book. I mean, I think it's such a great story and it's full of all of these incredible characters. I'm absolutely convinced that it needs to be turned into some really expensive, very bingeable period drama Netflix.
That would be
show.
Nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah, fingers crossed. But could you tell us a bit about the story and the main story in the book and how you first came across it?
Sure. Well, the book opens in the summer of 1705 with a masked woman depositing the manuscript of a pamphlet with a printer just off Fetter Lane in London. And the printer's name is David Edwards. And he's reluctant at first to print this book because the kind of material it contains is definitely going to get him in trouble. This book, called The Memorial of the Church of England, it just goes way too far in its attack against the government. It condemns what its authors call a heretic fever lurking in the bowels of the Church of England, for which it blames some of the most powerful men in the land. Inevitably, this printer, Edwards, has to go on the run soon thereafter. He's got government agents chasing him down. And the book, in essence, follows this chase for the men and women who are responsible for this book. And the man who's the mastermind behind this chase is the person whom we're going to be talking about a lot today, Robert Harley. The Secretaries of State were entrusted with regulating the press in this period. They were the people who would bring a prosecution against a printer. They were the people who had agents out on the street infiltrating printing houses and working out who was printing what, when, why, and for whom. And undoubtedly the most significant Secretary of State in the early part of the 18th century is this man, Robert Harley.
It's kind of testament to how amazing the source material must have been, because the book is so vivid and so, I guess that's why I was saying it was making me think of a really compelling TV programme, because it's, you know, you really describe it and I really feel like I'm there. There's one bit in particular that I just wanted to flag up. It was a particular favourite of mine, which was when Mary Edwards, who's the printer's wife, is describing the various kind of undercover work that she does to try and figure out who the author of the memorial is. And this is it that she's told Harley, or it's been repeated to Harley, and that's how we still have evidence of it today. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, yes, essentially she reports back to Harley on the kind of things that she's been getting up to, and she's putting on disguises, she's pretending to be other people to get into offices and have a search, potentially breaking into homes, she's meeting up with various other agents in taverns and coffee houses, doing all kinds of wonderful things. I mean, she's such a wonderful character.
Yeah. And you point out in your introduction that we think of this period of British history as being the dawn of the Enlightenment and religious toleration and, you know, the kind of a move towards a more rational, you know, free-thinking world that we recognise today. But actually, it's really not as simple as that, because there is suppression of, like, this text, the memorial.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we've really got a kind of a world that's on the cusp of something new, but is still deeply embedded in older ways of thinking, and older ways of doing things. So, you know, we've got people who are still thinking much the same way as they were 200 years earlier, but we've also got fringe figures who are on the edge of something really extraordinary. We're sort of perched on the cusp of enlightenment, but we're not quite there yet. And I think it's that kind of dialogue between, on the one hand, a censoring, persecuting society, and also the introduction of more tolerant ideas, that makes this such an exciting, dynamic, and important period. And yet also one of those periods that just doesn't really fit into our idea of where Britain was in the 18th century, but also this kind of trajectory that we have of the birth of the modern age in this period. It's far more messy, far more complex, and ultimately, I think, far more unpleasant than we've tended to think.
Definitely. I mean, so I'm studying an MA in journalism at the moment, so I was really interested in all of the stuff about the lapse of the Licensing Act in 1695 and that significance on a kind of explosion in newspapers that was happening at this time. That's obviously really important to the story as well, that there's this just sheer abundance of printed material.
So yes, what happens in 1695 is the old system of press licensing, essentially of pre-publication censorship, is allowed to lapse. The Parliamentary Act regulating that is allowed to lapse. But that doesn't mean it's the end of censorship. I mean, there's a great historical tradition with people saying that 1695 was this wonderful date. That was the birth of the modern age. The classic Whig historian Lord Macaulay said that the end of the Licensing Act was more important than the Magna Carta. It was more important than the Bill of Rights. It was truly the moment that Britain became a modern, liberal society. And it's just nonsense. It's complete nonsense. What happens is that censorship shifts from being something that happens before a book's published to being something that happens after a book's published. In essence, you've got freedom of speech, but you haven't got freedom after speech. If you print something that the authorities think is seditious, then they're going to pursue you, and they're going to pillory you, and they're going to burn that book.
I think we should probably move on to the year that you've chosen to speak about today. So if you could travel back in time to any year, what year would you choose?
I think it would be 1711.
Before we go to your first scene of 1711, the Memorial of the Church of England came out in 1705. So this is 6 years later. So what's happened in between that time that's going to inform the events of 1711?
So in many ways, the case has gone cold, as it were. Harley has chased suspects all over town, but he hasn't really got anywhere. And in 1708, he's fallen from power. And I think it's important to say that Harley really is one of the most natural politicians of the 18th century, perhaps ever to have lived. He's got this reputation as a kind of arch schemer, someone of diabolical cunning, this Machiavellian figure. One of his nicknames is Robin the Trickster, because he knows all the parliamentary procedures. Another is the Backstairs Dragon, because he's always found in those kind of servant stairs in the back rooms in Whitehall. But in 1710, there's this big event, the trial of Henry Sacheverell, who's this big high church firebrand preacher who's been impeached for saying some rather politically unsavoury things. But Harley sees that at this trial, the winds of public opinion are changing. Previously, they'd been blowing for the Whigs, Harley's rivals. But suddenly, there's a lot of sympathy for Sacheverell in the air, a lot of Tory sympathy for Sacheverell. And so Harley can see, well, maybe I should be allying myself to the Tories right now. Maybe I can use this to get myself back into power. So he's climbing up the greasy pole in 1710, but that position that he's just on the edge of is still quite precarious. So it's only in the spring of 1711, which is where I want to take us to, that he's consolidating his position and he's truly establishing himself, I think, as Britain's first prime minister.
So I think that takes us perfectly to our first scene that you're taking us to, which is a Wednesday night in February 1711. So would you like to tell us where we are and who we're with?
Sure. Essentially, we're knocking at the front door of the Bell Tavern in King Street in Westminster. We're making our way upstairs and going into one of the large upstairs private rooms in this tavern. And when we open the door, we're finding 70 or 80 people, all of whom are Tory MPs, backbench Tory MPs, many of them newly elected in the general elections. So they don't have any parliamentary experience, a lot of them. They're a bit unruly, and they're drinking, they're smoking, and they are plotting against this man, Harley, who they can see has ridden the political winds that they have carried him on. We've got brilliant testimony about this club from none other than Jonathan Swift, a famous author of Gulliver's Travels. But at this stage of his career, he's one of Harley's key allies, the key propagandist for Harley. And he's reporting to his friends that this group that meets in the Bell Tavern is called the October Club. And they meet every evening at a tavern near Parliament to consult affairs, Swift says, and drive things on to extremes against the Whigs, to call the old ministry to account and to get off 5 or 6 heads. In other words, what Swift's saying is there's this factious extremist group of backbenchers who are really unsatisfied with Harley, not because he's a Tory, they like that, but because he's not Tory enough. He's not persecuting the old Godolphin regime. And essentially they're saying that Harley's too much of a moderate and needs to come over more to their side. So it's a pressure group, essentially, meeting in the upstairs rooms of these taverns.
And what was the aim of the October Club? What do you think were there? What were they wanting to see happen in Britain?
They had 3 core aims, really, that they would discuss while guzzling on this October beer and smoking Mundungus. Those aims are, firstly, a full and thorough inquiry into the misconduct of the previous administration. They want to see people tried for crimes against the state, which is a fairly audacious thing to be saying at any point in time. Secondly, they want to investigate what they perceive as the government's continued failure to protect the Church of England from the rot of nonconformity. This was a rallying cry that really started with the memorial. People saying that the great national Church of England is being undermined by these dissenters, these Protestants who don't subscribe to the beliefs of the Church of England. And there's a common suspicion that if you weren't religiously orthodox, then you couldn't be politically orthodox. If you dissented from the church, then you probably dissented from the state. So essentially, these Tories think that all dissenters are closet Republicans and they need to be hounded out and either forced to subscribe to the Church of England or maybe chucked out of the country like the Huguenots. So the third policy that they're really hot on is settling a peace with France. Since 1702, England has been at war with France in the War of the Spanish Succession. And this was a fundamentally very costly and expensive war that had been dragging on for years and years. And these Tory squires thought they were paying way too much in tax, so they wanted it over. So those are the 3 policies that the October Club are really hot on. And they think that Harley is letting them down in each of those 3 areas.
Just on the point about dissenters, how real was the threat of dissenting Protestants? Or was it a kind of totally imagined one, do you think?
It really didn't exist. Dissenters were neither numerous enough nor politically enfranchised enough to make a huge difference. And it's important to remember that in this period, there was something called the Test Act that applied to public office. You essentially had to take a sworn statement that you weren't a Catholic, that you didn't believe in transubstantiation in order to hold public office. That was meant to wheedle out Catholics. But it also applied to dissenters, Protestant dissenters as well. And they could get around this by a practice known as occasional conformity. In other words, they'd go to church every now and then to sort of tick some government boxes, and that meant they could then take full part in state activities. But there's a real sense of unease with Tories about occasional conformity. They don't like it one bit. For them, they fundamentally think that in order to be a fully fledged member of the English state, you've got to be a fully fledged member of the English church. Part of the rallying cry of the memorial is that occasional conformity has to be outlawed. And it isn't for many years. And then in 1711, we start to see that cry really become much louder. Once again, thanks to the October Club. So they, in some ways, they kind of resuscitate the rallying cry that the memorial first gave in 1705.
And this fear is kind of it's a bit of a hangover, isn't it, from the Civil War, because that's where the association between Protestant dissenting and republicanism was first formed. And
absolutely.
It's something that really struck me reading about the various ideological conflicts in this book, that this is a nation that is still kind of reeling from the political and social trauma of the 17th century, you know.
Yeah.
It's like
the fighting never stopped.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the most, I was kind of thinking about this, like, is it the most politically traumatic century? I'm sure lots of historians of different centuries would say that their one was the most politically traumatic century for British history, but
I think they'd be wrong. I think the 17th century is without doubt the most politically traumatic in Britain.
Yeah.
Not only do you have the execution of a king and the revolution in 1688 to 89, often scholars separate out, I think, the 17th century into two halves. They hinge it around 1660, you know, this period called the Restoration, somehow seen as separate from the Civil Wars, as though everything changes in 1660 and we get, you know, the Enlightenment starting to happen. And it's just not true. I think that the scars of the Civil Wars absolutely take decades to heal. And I think we're well into the 18th century before those scars fully heal. Maybe we're getting up as far as the American Revolution.
So the October Club are meeting in the Bell Tavern and they're plotting against Harley. What is their conclusion? What is even in their power to achieve at this point? I mean, there are newly elected MPs, they're backbenchers. What kind of power and tools do they have available to them to get Robert Harley in the place they want him to be?
That's a really interesting question, because in some ways, because Harley is such an experienced parliamentary operator, he finds it very difficult to manage these political neophytes, because they just don't play by the rules. And so Harley's finding it immensely difficult to whip them all into line and to get them on his side. One of Harley's strategies for turning things around is really what we might call now spin. Harley is a pioneer of political spin. I've already mentioned Jonathan Swift, who is one of his chief writers. The other one is Daniel Defoe, famously the author of Robinson Crusoe. And Swift and Defoe are writing pamphlets for Harley, kind of supporting this idea of a political centre ground, a politically moderate government that could have some Tories and some Whigs and bring everyone together into a happy middle. That's Harley's aim. Harley hates the idea of being enthralled to a single political party. And so a hung parliament is exactly what he wants, because he can pick off people on either side and have this middle ground. But in 1710, they're in a Tory landslide. So the problem that he has is that the Tory party are now really, really powerful in a way that he hadn't necessarily expected. So he's really trying to manage this rabble in the best way that he can. And they're starting to prove quite dangerous for him. With the next scene, that's the thing that kind of turns it around. So I think we kind of end here with Harley in a slightly precarious state.
So what happens next? What's the next scene that you would like to visit in 1711?
We're going to fast forward by a month to the 8th of March, and a chilly afternoon in the Secretary of State's offices, the cockpit buildings in Whitehall. Now, the 8th of March is significant for a couple of reasons. One, it's Queen Anne's accession day. It's the anniversary of her coming to the throne. So everybody is a bit dressed up. Everybody, you know, is going off to feasts in the evening. So it's a day where you don't really want to be doing too much business. And yet, the entire cabinet is converging on the cockpit building to interrogate a suspected French spy. Now, this spy is called the Marquis de Guiscard, and he's a French spy who came over to London, I think, 6 or 7 years earlier. And he was a defector, in essence. He was promising the English government all kinds of intelligence on the French military system. He was initially given a lucrative government pension as a reward for all this. But once it became clear that actually Guiscard's intelligence wasn't worth the paper it was written on, his pension started to fall into arrears, and all of his influential friends suddenly forgot about him. And his credibility with the government was ultimately shot. Guiscard is not happy with this. He's down and out in London, enraged by this lack of reward that he thinks is his right. And so Guiscard decides to leak information back across the channel. He turns double agent and he starts plotting with representatives from his homeland. And this is when he's caught in 1711 in the spring. And he's taken to Whitehall and he's sat there in the cockpit buildings around a table with the full cabinet asking all kinds of questions. And he's revealing very little. He's not saying much at all, even though he knows he's in trouble. And as he's being taken away to be put back in his cell, he lunges across the table at Harley. He whips a knife, goodness knows from where, and stabs him square in the chest twice. And this is just an extraordinary moment. You have members of the cabinet jumping up, lunging across the table with their own rapiers, running Guiscard through. He has to be dragged off by guards. Sidonie has to be dragged off the Frenchman before killing him outright, because the ministers, they want to keep Guiscard alive. You know, they know that he's got intelligence that they need. They need to finish this interrogation. And as I mentioned a moment ago, it's the anniversary of Anne's accession. So everybody's dressed up, and that includes Harley. And to mark the anniversary, he's wearing his best waistcoat, pale blue silk, but it's thickly embellished with gold thread. And on top of that, he's got a heavy woolen overcoat lined with buckram. And so as the blade slices first through the wadding of the coat, then into this gold embroidery, the force of the blow is weakened. And that means that when the knife strikes into Harley's breastbone, it snaps. And so Guiscard manages this second jab, but he's dragged away before he manages to do any real damage. Now, for a few hours, Harley's survival does seem to hang in the balance. But his wound's clean, it's treatable. After a few weeks in bed, he's going to be back on his feet. But this would-be assassin, Guiscard, he's not so lucky. Because in the ensuing fracas, Guiscard himself is run through by St. John. And now, doctors are called to the scene immediately to try and keep Guiscard alive. But inevitably, the wounds go fetid, and he dies a week later in Newgate. Now, this is obviously an explosive moment, but it also marks a real turning point in Harley's fortunes. Because for the last month, he's had the October Club breathing down his neck, saying, "You need to become more like us. We need you to pass true Tory laws. We need you to govern on the behalf of the true blue high churchman." And all this while, Harley's trying to say, no, you should come more to my moderate centre ground, and that's where we can do business. But after this assassination attempt goes public, everyone is on Harley's side. After all, if you're considered important enough for a French spy to take a jab at you in the middle of Whitehall, I mean, this is such an audacious thing to do, then obviously you are an important patriotic Englishman. And so this is when we start to see the turning point in Harley's fortunes. This is where we start to see public opinion to his side.
Oh, it's absolutely gripping stuff. I particularly love that thing about his clothes protecting him, and it just happened to be on that day. And if it had been any other day, that might have been the end of him.
It's just it could well have been.
Yeah, wonderful kind of historical coincidences that I love. So the reaction is an overwhelmingly positive one for Harley.
It is. But there's also a few sort of unsolved puzzles that come out of this moment. One of them is that this man who I mentioned, Henry St. John, who is Harley's deputy at the time, he's just as ambitious as Harley. And he's also very nearly as skilled when it comes to the kind of underhand aspect of politics. And St. John, as soon as he's out of Whitehall, he seems to start putting it about that he was the real target of the assassination attempt. He starts whispering into people's ears, including Swift, saying, "Ah, yes, but Guiscard really meant the knife for me. It's just that Harley was in the way." So you can see that you've also got Sir John here trying to turn the situation to his advantage. While his mentor is out of the way, maybe he'll be able to step forward and fill this power vacuum. He's a young, hot-blooded Tory who can really rise to the moment, he thinks. And so there's that unsolved puzzle there. But we've also got another puzzle, which is where the hell did this knife come from? You know, if Guiscard is working as a lone agent, which it seems he was, how did he manage to smuggle a knife into the heart of Whitehall and try and assassinate Britain's Prime Minister? This is shocking. And we know where he got this knife. Or at least we know Harley thinks he got this knife. And this is due to an astonishing document that survives in the British Library. And it's a copy of a pamphlet. So naturally, there are lots of pamphlets about this event, all saying how heroic Harley has been to survive the attempt on his life. But this particular copy of this pamphlet was Harley's own copy. And where the pamphlet reports that there was simply a penknife used for sharpening quills by the clerks, and it had just been left in the chamber by some careless clerk, and as Guiscard was dragged into the chamber, he managed to somehow pick it up from a table and slip it up his sleeve. Harley himself, in his own copy, crosses through this with an elaborate flourish of his pen and scribbles in the margin that no, this is not true. The knife was given to Guiscard by one of the guards.
Mm.
Now, there's a couple of potential suggestions here. One is that maybe he'd been brought some food, some bread and cheese before this interrogation. You know, he was sitting there for hours and hours and hours. And that this guard had just forgotten to take the knife back. Guiscard might have snuck it into his pocket or up his sleeve or whatever. But there's also a more sinister implication here. Perhaps there was something bigger going on. You know, we just don't know. But either way, it's certainly not as cut and dried an episode as the press tries to make it out to have been at the time.
Mm. I mean, I suppose Harley was a man who spent his entire life investigating coups and plots and intrigue, so you could imagine that he would be prone to interpret something like that as being part of a wider plot, you know.
Absolutely.
For the bigger
story. There's also rumours that, you know, Harley is the political intriguer of his day. And so is it truly beyond thought that he might have engineered the whole thing himself?
Mm.
There are rumours spreading that Harley had actually engineered this opportunity to bolster his reputation. He knew that he wasn't quite where he needed to be. He knew that his grasp on the Tory party was slipping. And how might he get it back? Well, surviving an attempt by a French assassin was a pretty damn audacious way of consolidating your reputation. But, you know, maybe it was something that he had orchestrated. Don't think it was, looking at, you know, Harley's own recollection of the event. But again, it's something that's being put out there by disgruntled MPs, maybe members of the October Club. Maybe it's his deputy, Henry St. John. We just don't know. But either way, there are murmurs of discontent out there.
And I remember reading in your book that the Queen Anne, is meant to have cried all night when she hears about this attack on Harley, because they were quite close, weren't they?
They were. And indeed, that's one of the ways that Harley really gets back into power, is because the Queen likes him. The other members of the triumvirate, Godolphin and Marlborough, you know, they'd been loyal servants of Anne for years and years and years, decades even. But she never really liked them in the way that she liked Harley. Harley used to brief the Queen secretly after hours on precisely what was going in Parliament. He was seen as a trusted aide to Anne. So the fact that she was particularly cut up by this episode is no real surprise. Likewise with our friend Jonathan Swift. He was playing cards when the news reached him and instantly threw down his hand, left all his money go. And knowing how much Swift cared about his money, that's really quite something. And he runs across town to Harley's bedside to try and find out how he's going to be. He describes himself as heartbroken by this news. So, you know, he's got friends. Mm. He's got friends who care about him. But he's also clever enough to know when you can capitalise a moment, seize the moment and make it work for you rather than against you.
Definitely. I think just for any film fans who are listening, I thought it was interesting that Harley's niece is Abigail Masham, who is the subject of the film The Favourite with Olivia Colman that came out a couple of years ago. That's right, isn't it?
It is, yes. Yeah. And Harley himself, he's in the film. It. I think it's Nicholas Holt who plays him.
Yeah.
And he's a slightly foppish character.
Yeah.
In that, and I think the interpretation of Harley there is almost a cross between St. John, the protege, who was notably foppish, and Harley himself, who was a slightly more complex character, let's say.
Hi, I'm Artemis. At Travels Through Time, we're incredibly proud to be partnering with Jordan Lloyd, one of the world's leading visual historians. His extraordinary photo colorization work has appeared on the covers of National Geographic, Life, and People magazines, and he's worked on special projects for titles like The Times of London and NPR. Through his expertly researched and detailed work, Jordan has brought to life some of the most famous events and people from modern history, whether it's his portrait of Abraham Lincoln or his sweeping panorama of the D-Day beaches in 1944. One of my current favourites is a photograph taken on the 1911 Terra Nova expedition to the Antarctic. The original shot is strange and beautiful, and it shows just how otherworldly parts of our planet can sometimes look. But the image is completely elevated by the deep and icy blues that Jordan's colourisation work brings out. This, alongside many others, are available to buy as prints, and they make an unusual and striking present for that friend or family member of yours who loves the past. To find your favourite historical image, have a look at Jordan's site at www.colourgraph.co.
So he's been attacked. He's sat in bed, stuck at home, out of the action, but he is enjoying the reputation that this attempt on his life has given him. And he recovers, obviously, luckily. That takes us to our third scene.
It does. Just over a month later. So he's in bed for 6 weeks. He's keeping up to date on pamphlets and on events in Parliament. One of the pamphlets that crosses his lap while he's in bed is a reprint of The Memorial of the Church of England, the book that the paper chase explores. And there's a new introduction there saying that actually, no, Harley has survived this assassination attempt, and therefore maybe he's not so bad as we used to think he was. But generally speaking, yeah, that's absolutely right. He's enjoying how his reputation is being burnished by this event. He's gradually recovering. He's coming back to full health. And then on the 26th of April, which is the third date I want to take us to, he re-enters the House of Commons. And this is a really grand event. You know, this is the first time he's been out in public, really, since he was stabbed. And he enters the House of Commons. Now, let's remember that you've got members of the October Club in here. You've got members of the Whig Party who utterly hate Harley's to his boots. And so Harley is really, you know, walking into the dragon's den, as it were. Anything could happen. The Speaker of the House of Commons is a real high-flying, true blue Tory, William Bromley. He's a darling of the October Club. William Bromley delivers a speech. I'll read an extract from it here. When the barbarous and villainous attempt made upon by the Seigneur de Guiscard, a French papist, was communicated to this house, they immediately declared they were most deeply affected to find such an instance of inveterate malice against you. And observing how you have been treated by some persons, they concluded they had reason to believe that your fidelity to Her Majesty and zeal for her service had drawn upon you the hatred of all the abettors of popery and faction. In other words, he's saying here that the fact that this French papist decided that he needed to kill you means that you must be the most loyal servant of Queen Anne. You must be the person who was promised to deliver the nation in this moment. And it's an absolute vindication of Harley. And when Harley responds, as he inevitably does, He says, "Whenever I look upon my breast, it will always put me in mind of the thanks due to God, my duty to the Queen, and that debt of gratitude and service I must always owe to this honourable house." And a lot of people have remarked on this phrase, "whenever I look upon my breast." What does he mean there? Well, he's talking about the scars. Mm. He's talking about the marks left on his skin by this French assassin. And he's saying whenever he's going to look at these scars on his chest, he will remember God, the Queen, and Parliament. And of course, the Tories go wild for this. They think he's brilliant. And essentially, within the month, he's taken up position as Lord High Treasurer. He's completely dominating Parliament. And he starts to force through peace with France, which was, of course, one of the demands of the October Club. In some ways, Harley really does start to become a bit more Tory at this point. But he also starts to consolidate his grip on power.
And do you think his, up to now, his kind of straddling of the two parties, is that the one foot in with the Tories and still kind of consolidating with the Whigs, is that born out of a genuine belief in moderation and centrism, or is it more of a political tool?
His moderate principles are absolutely held. There is no doubt whatsoever that Harley was, to his boots, a moderate. He started life as a Whig, then he became a Tory. He was raised as a Puritan, and then he became a high churchman. And that's because I think he thought he was staying constant to himself, that he was always staying true to what he believed in. He saw just the parties around him start to shift. I think that's what Harley would have said. But at this moment, he realises that he can't really govern in the way that he'd like. He'd like, as I mentioned earlier, to have members of Parliament from both sides drawn to him as a single moderate government figure. But he realises the Tories are just too powerful at the moment, and that maybe the only way to blunt their most egregious impulses is to join them, is for him to say, "Fine, you in the October Club, I'm going to do what you ask. I'm going to outlaw occasional conformity. I'm going to work for the church. I'm going to arrange peace with France, but I'm going to do it on my terms." And that's how I think Harley, you know, he simultaneously stays true to himself and he also answers their call. He sort of sells out, but not quite. And that's just a matter of political expedience. Mm. You know, he's clever enough to know which way the winds are blowing. In 1710, when he saw the Tories were on the up, he attached himself to them. In 1711, when he saw that he had a bit more power, he said, "Okay, you come with me." And this kind of shifting path that he manages to weave through the politics of this era, a testament, I think, to a huge amount of political skill, but also to this genuinely held belief in moderation.
And this is this moment in April 1711, and is that the pinnacle of Harley's career? This is him, he's basically made it at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is when he consolidates power. You know, all through 1710, as I said, he's climbing that greasy pole, and this is when he finally gets to the top, and he's made it. Now, sure, you've still got the October Club snapping at his ankles, but its teeth have been pulled, you know. And after another couple of years, Harley does finally manage to get his peace treaty settled. And so, yeah, 1711, I think, really is the absolute pinnacle of his powers. And it carries right through to 1713, early 1714. And then, sadly, things sort of go wrong for Harley. His deputy, who I mentioned, Henry St. John, starts plotting against him in earnest. Harley's daughter, whom he loved dearly, died. He turns to the bottle. He becomes a bit more cryptic in the way that he deals with the Queen. The Queen gets really fed up with this. She really cites his cryptic manner of speech as a reason why she just can't be dealing with him anymore. Mm. And a week before the Queen herself dies in August 1714, she fires Harley. She says, "Nope, I'm not having any more of this." And Henry St. John, the man who had stabbed his assassin, the man who sort of engineered all those rumours and murmurs about Harley orchestrating this plot against his own life, that's who replaces him. After the death of the Queen, we have the start of the Georgian era in 1714, but George can't be dealing with Harley. Harley was loyal to Queen Anne, but he certainly isn't going to be loyal to George. And plus, George and his ministers really thought that the peace treaty with France was a terrible idea. They initiated an impeachment against Harley very quickly after taking power. And Harley ended up in the Tower of London for years. And it was really a hard downfall for a man who had once been at the absolute pinnacle of political life in Britain.
Well, they say, don't they, that every political career ends in failure. So before we head back to the present, you're allowed to bring a memento with you from 1711.
That would be the broken knife that snapped in Harley's chest. The knife that Guiscard used for his attempted assassination of Harley.
That's a good one.
Because we know he gave it, we know it ended up in Swift's hands. Swift kept it as a kind of relic of his old friend and patron, and it passed down the family and eventually back to Harley's relatives, who, so far as I'm aware, have it to this day.
Wow.
So I know it's out there somewhere, and I would absolutely love to, you know, weigh that in my hand.
He's a kind of one of those political figures that, you know, to rival Thomas Cromwell, that was a comparison that I was thinking of as we were speaking, a real genius at the political machinations of court and king and queen and all of the different players. I find those kind of characters absolutely fascinating in history.
You know, people often say that the Britain's first prime minister was Robert Walpole, who came to power a decade later. But it's not. Harley absolutely controlled the apparatus of power in a way that nobody had for decades before him. And the means by which he came by that power is just a wonderful story, and it deserves to be better known.
Well, thank you so much for sharing it with us today, Joseph. And I very much encourage anyone to, and everyone to read The Paper Chase or buy it as a Christmas present, because it's a fantastic read, so thrillingly.
Thank you, it's very kind of you.
So thanks so much for being on Travels Through Time today, Joseph. That was a fantastic conversation.
Thank you.
That was me, Artemis Irvin, talking to Dr. Joseph Hone about the year 1711. His new book, The Paper Chase, is published by Chatto and Windus and is available to buy now. There was so much more that I wanted to ask Joseph about this book, which might give you a sense of what a great read it is and how packed it is with fascinating insights into this particular, somewhat unloved moment in British history, in my opinion. Join us next week for a trip to the Regency era with Sunday Times bestselling author Ian Mortimer. Until then, goodbye.